Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Damian Broderick. He's a science fiction author and the author of many pop science, cultural studies kinds of articles and books. There are more 30 titles in all. He's a senior fellow at the University of Melbourne. Welcome, Damian.
Hi, James.
Now, the book that I have called you to talk about most particularly is called The Spike, which has been published recently in the United States. It's a book about the transhumanist idea of a coming singularity, a confluence of many different technologies. Is your concept of the spike pretty much the same as the concept of the singularity as proposed by transhumanists?
I think you could say that. The spike is really a metaphor. It's a figure of speech to try to encapsulate the idea that our experience is going to be shaped quite drastically in the next somewhere between 10 and 50 years by some of the technologies running away very, very fast, so fast that when you actually graph it, when you draw a diagram of it, it appears as though the line which has been travelling along almost flat starts to curve upwards very fast, faster and faster, in fact, until the line of change is going straight upwards, straight up the page. And that it looks a bit like a spike. It doesn't come down the other side, we hope. But that's the kind of impact that we can expect as these technologies augment each other.
And what are some of the technologies that we're talking about?
The basic technology, I guess, is computer power, computational grunt, for a given amount of money. So that it's been the case for 40 or 50 years that computational power that's been accessible to humans has increased at a rate of, well, it's doubled. It's doubled every somewhere between 18 months and 1 year at the moment. So that you can get a computer, to put it crudely, you can get a computer worth $1,000 that's twice as good in a year's time, and four times as good in 2 years' time, and eight times as good in 3 years' time. Of course, that's offset by the fact that you have to run Windows on it. So,
Now, the impact of that AI, the original concept of singularity per se, was proposed by Werner Vinge, who thought that the advent of self-aware artificial intelligence, self-willed artificial intelligence, would rapidly change all of human existence. Is that the focus of your attention, or do you think other technologies need to be factored in as well?
That certainly does seem to be the key to the idea of the spike. There are all sorts of other technologies depend on having cheap and powerful computation. For example, molecular engineering or nanotechnology will probably emerge, as will proteomics, which is the effective use of the genome, now that we know it. All of these things will emerge faster and faster because of the depth of understanding that's available to us with cheap, extensive computer power. But the most astonishing thought, and one which is still really up for grabs, is that at some point, somewhere between, 10 years and 50 years from now, the computers will themselves equal human intelligence, and then they'll start to rewrite their own code. That's something that we can't do. It doesn't matter how smart we are, we can modify our consciousness a little bit by disciplines or by neurotransmitters or whatever, but we can't get in there and actually rejig the shape of our brains. However, computers can do that, so that once you've got a computer that's as smart as a human, it should be possible for it to either build another computer, to generate another computer perhaps by a kind of evolutionary process, or even to rewrite itself so that it's smarter. And then once it's that little bit smarter, it can make itself even more smart. So we can see this kind of runaway occur in which a whole new order of intelligence and possibly consciousness will emerge on the surface of the Earth to share it with us.
Vinge argued that for us to actually survive this coming transition to super intelligent machines, we had to begin to become super intelligent ourselves. And Ray Kurzweil has proposed in his writings that we should be able to put small computer-based networks inside our own brains and become super intelligent and self-programming in the same way that you're saying computers are. Is that something that you also foresee?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds creepy, doesn't it? We don't like this idea of, I mean, what it amounts to is putting a sort of machine soul inside ourselves. That's how we tend to think of it. We don't have any analogies for this kind of thing. People keep falling back onto ideas that were promoted 200 years ago. You know, Frankenstein. Oh, my God, Frankenstein, the monster. Prior to that, you know, we had things like the golem in Jewish myth, these great clanking, terrible things. Now, of course, it wouldn't be anything like that. It would be much more like wearing a pair of glasses, which I do, luckily, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to read. There are people now with mechanical hearts. It's just started, of course, but, you know, sooner or later, these sorts of adjuncts to our frail bodies will become quite commonplace. Will we then amplify ourselves with chip technology? I don't know. I suppose so, but I think what's really going to happen is going to be much more awesome and strange than that. For example, one of the ideas that I discuss quite a lot in Spike is the idea of uploading, which is based on the notion that using advanced scanning technology, the sort that we've already got, magnetic resonance and so on, laser ablation and God knows what all, we might be able to actually read off the structure of a living brain in absolute detail, down to the neuronal level, the synaptic connections between the neurons and so on, and make a kind of functional copy of that inside one of these enormously expansive computers that will be available to us in 15 or 20 years. And then when you run that machine, it will be the equivalent of your mind having been copied into it. That's a pretty astonishing thought. Does that mean that I'll happily then die knowing that I will live on inside the computer? I don't think so. I mean, it'll be my twin, my exact twin, but it won't be me. But still, it'll make a hell of a lot of difference to the world that we live in.
Now, when you talk about achieving some kind of functional immortality through, or at least a dramatic expansion of your personal identity continuity through these technologies, and they're occurring suddenly at a future date, some 30, 40 years in the future, it sounds a lot like the old Christian ideas of the millennium, of some kind of a millenarian expectation. Do you think that there may be different evidentiary basis for this millennium, but do you think that people in this transhumanist milieu who are talking about these ideas are appropriating this idea of the spike or the singularity in a millenarian way? Are there structural parallels to old-fashioned millenarianism?
James, I reject that absolutely because it seems to me a very dangerous line of thought. One can see how people might think that, but then you could imagine that 200 years ago, people sitting around saying, I reckon that one of these days we'll have machines that enable us to fly through the skies. And all the theologians would sit there self-satisfactorily saying, ah, I can see what you're doing there. You're appropriating the idea of angelic flight. You're trying to imagine that this is how spirits move through the heavens. Therefore, you know, it's on the one hand, it's impossible, and on the second hand, it's deeply impious to even imagine that we could do this. In fact, of course, we want to go through the skies simply because, well, it's a wonderful thing to do, terrific experience, but it's also a very clean and efficient way of moving from one place to the other. The fact that people have dreamed of these things in the past has nothing to do with the technological fact that we can now do it. And similarly, I think with a lot of these remarkable expectations that we have about what happens when technology goes exponential, yes, indeed, they will bring human beings astonishing power, the power that people in the past have had to ascribe to imaginary gods, but that has nothing to do with the fact that they are independently generated by our scientific knowledge of the world. It's very dangerous, I think, in fact, to start to apply mythology or theology to these expectations, because that can take us off into all kinds of grandiose and absurd expectations.
I'm speaking with Damian Broderick. He's a culture critic, science fiction author, and author of nonfiction titles such as most recently The Spike, How Our Lives Are Being Transformed by Rapidly Advancing Technologies. And I'm speaking to him in Australia. The publication of the article, The Future Doesn't Need Us, by Bill Joy and Wired in 2000, was a shot across the bow of a lot of folks in the transhumanist community who had been dealing with a lot of Luddite concerns about these technologies, but suddenly one of our own had gone apostate. Do you think that the apprehension of apocalyptic scenarios of self-reproducing nanotechnology, of genetic plagues, of AI gone amok, that these are as likely, more likely, less likely?
It's pretty obvious to me that these ideas have always been taken seriously by those few of us who've really been looking at the runaway technologies that underlie their possibility. When the terrible crime of September the 11th occurred, I was sitting here in Australia watching it from the very beginning in real time on television, which is an astonishing thought in itself. Halfway around the world, I was able to actually watch this event while probably most of the people in America were still asleep and not aware of it. But the thing is that those awful events were caused by evil people, misguided people, appropriating the existing technology and using it to their own ends. Now, it seems to me absolutely clear that the same sort of thing will occur when we have even more powerful technologies. It's going to be very difficult to stop people using nanomachines, which are capable of replicating themselves and building anything we like from the atom up, assuming that we have a good description of it, any more than we can stop people making anthrax spores and sticking them in envelopes and posting them around the world. So, yeah, I mean, it's a scary prospect, but then humans have always had scary prospects to confront, and we've managed reasonably well.
So what do we do about it?
Well, we prepare ourselves very hard by taking it seriously to start with. I mean, we do have to realize that these spike technologies are coming. We've got to get over the idea that everything is continuing at roughly the same rate as it always has. I mean, that's the underlying assumption, I think, that we've evolved to have. You know, we expect that the rain will come tomorrow and the sun after that, and then you can never be too sure when there'll be some hail. So we're aware that there's all kinds of small changes, but what we don't expect is the big meteor that comes down and smashes the planet. We don't expect the volcano. We're not evolved to deal with these giant discontinuous changes, so it's very difficult for us to routinely think about exponential change. So therefore, we have to force ourselves to confront it. We have to get past, for that matter, the kind of glib excitement of being terribly thrilled by it. That's the sort of thing that, I must say, science fiction has always pleased me with. It's had the capacity to foresee great change, although I must say most of it missed the spike. But
do you write about the spike?
I'm sorry?
Does your fiction, your science fiction, portray spiky scenarios?
Oh, up to a point. Generally speaking, though, there's a kind of problem here, which is that if you're writing fiction for people who are living here now, with ordinary human bodies, with ordinary human expectations, it's rather difficult to tell an engaging story that really comes to terms with singularity propositions. The only person I can think of, well, apart from Werner Vinge himself, has had several quite interesting goes at it, is Greg Egan, an Australian writer who's written a number of novels, such as Diaspora and Permutation City, which just rush headlong into this idea that the future is going to be drastically different.
Very challenging novels.
I'm sorry?
Very challenging, but very mind-expanding.
Well, that's right, but also rather off-putting. You know, if you're a literary reader, for example, you say, you know, I don't want to know about these creatures. They're not human. They might love each other in some sense. They might have arguments, but my God, they're awful. They're strange. They're creepy. So, I mean, this is the problem. It's very difficult to create genuinely enthralling fiction that takes this stuff seriously. I've tried to do it most recently in a couple of novels that are still coming up. There's one that's coming out next year from Tor called Transcension, which is set in a post-spike future, but in a kind of Amish enclave, you might say, in which the people that we're reading about are in a kind of tucked away little safe corner, which doesn't know that the spike has actually happened. They live, in fact, under what I call the joyous relinquishment, which is a slightly sardonic crack at our friend Bill Joy. But, I mean, I can imagine that that might happen. It could be that in 50 years' time, superintelligence will emerge on the Earth, will spread very rapidly, and will look upon us with a kind of detached kindliness because we're its parents, and it'll say, we'll look after you guys, we'll even look after you to the extent that we'll hide ourselves from you because it would be too much of a shock if you realized that you're just the ants now.
So you do foresee a future in which humanity and post-humanity have become so separate from each other that the most that we can have for humanity, the most kind of feelings that post-humanity could have for humanity would be pity.
Or fondness. I don't know. I mean, the whole point really about the spike is that the spike is a wall against our understanding of the future, against our capacity to predict what it will be like. Now, that doesn't stop me, in fact, spending about 400 pages in the spike trying to predict it, or trying to at least predict a sheaf of possible pathways to it. But at some point, we have to say, what's it like when you've got an almost unlimited technology, but you're stuck on a single planet? Obviously, the first thing that they're going to do is to expand beyond the Earth, apart from anything else, because they'd ruin the Earth if they stayed here. They'd eat it up. So we have to hope that they won't decide to do that. But once you get off the planet, there's all sorts of energy is available freely from the sun and the stars. There's all kinds of mass that can be used to build wonderful structures, including other intelligences. So something like a kind of science fiction future is certainly going to occur. I'd be very surprised if some of this hasn't already happened by 2100. And I'd also be very surprised if some of the people who are alive now aren't still alive in 2100. I mean, one of the other arguments that I advance is that medical technology, using things like nanotech and so on, will extend our lives incrementally, bit by bit. So, I think I'll probably die. I think it's probably too late for me because I'm too old. But I'm hoping, even so, that with little improvements, we'll find that we can cure most cancers probably in the next 5 or 10 years. Heart disease will probably be solved, more or less. Alzheimer's seems to be on the verge of being fixed, and so on. Parkinson's. If we can just find enough small fixes for the way that our cells decay, the way that our organs break down, we may be able to continue our individual lives to the point where we become, in effect, immortal. That is to say that we have a kind of indefinite lifespan that can only be halted by our deciding to stop or by being run over by a space truck or something.
You've also written about the politics and the economics of abundance in this future society, and one of the old tropes from Marxism is that when the means of production are developed to a certain point, they conflict with the relations of production. I can imagine, for instance, a scenario in which a superabundant nanotechnology, that is a nanotechnology that would provide for everyone's needs, would be held back by a privately owned corporate megastructure, because why would they want to sell a technology that would destroy the market for any of their future goods and perhaps the economy as a whole? Do you see that there might be that kind of conflict between the capitalist system that we have and the kind of superabundance that nanotechnology might provide?
Sure. I mean, that's the sort of thing that we've already found happening with Napster and MP3s and various. But on the other hand, you have to remember that open source structures for developing computer software have been quite successful in their way. And I saw today that IBM are about to release $40 million worth of their proprietary software tools onto the open source network so that people will be able to actually generate all kinds of new software that will pay off for IBM in the long run. I think in the meantime, what we'll see is a kind of, the usual unholy blend between big corporations and government to clamp down on these things in the same way that it's happening with copyright and so on already. But on the other hand, as we know, the net can't really be closed down unless you shut the whole thing down, unless you get rid of all the computers or put chips into them that stop people using them freely. Information wants to be free. It gets out there. And once the technology has been designed, it seems to me quite possible. I mean, all you need really, perhaps, is one effective nano-replicator system, because it can then make a copy of itself. And then it's out running free, so to speak. Now, I don't know that I necessarily want to see a world in which everybody has a little black box on the kitchen bench, which can produce anthrax or sarin gas. I mean, that'd be pretty nasty. So we're going to have some kinds of restrictions on the way these things can be used and programmed. But it's certainly clear that if we do have a massive extension of very cheap productivity, sure, you know, I mean, all the current economic structures are going to be thrown into upheaval. But then, I mean, that happened already in the past when, for example, petroleum was, uses for petroleum were discovered. You could replace the horses with these sort of horses carriage things. Those people who had been rich suddenly weren't rich anymore, and all sorts of poor people became rich. Will we still be talking about rich and poor in a world of complete abundance? I don't know. I mean, people will still want to live by the sea, you know, so there's only a limited amount of sea coast. But on the other hand, lots of people will be able to live in arid landscapes now using solar technology that's been generated by, you know, nanomachines, and so on and so forth, in places which are now fairly unpleasant to live in, but they'll be, as it were, terraformed using this. So it's quite conceivable that people, by and large, will have the benefits of abundance without necessarily needing many of the structures that we have now. But it's going to be tremendous conflict, I'm sure.
I'm speaking with Damian Broderick. He's the author of The Spike, How Our Lives Are Being Transformed by Rapidly Advancing Technologies, and he's speaking to me from Australia. In the middle of The Spike, you have an argument that guaranteed minimum wage, or a social wage, as it's sometimes called, the idea that we deserve as a right of citizenship to be supported to some extent, something that's anathema to many American libertarians. You have this proposition in the middle of the book as a natural consequence of the economic dislocations caused by these spiky technologies. How do you come to those conclusions? What do you think is going to happen to work? Is automation going to take over everything? Is that why you advocate this?
Certainly the idea of the guaranteed income or the negative income tax base was first being pushed back in the 50s and the early 60s by economists who rather optimistically expected that automation, as they then understood it, would soon throw everybody out of work. I found the ideas discussed by a British-American economist named Robert Theobald, who died a year or so ago. I found his ideas quite persuasive at the time, both on economic and moral grounds. It seems to me quite legitimate to imagine that if you have a series of technical advances which make the owners of those advances obscenely rich, but at the cost of downsizing or throwing out of work all the people who used to work for the corporation, then it makes perfectly good moral sense to me to say, let us set aside some of this fantastic dividend of history and share it amongst the people who made it possible in the first place. I don't actually think that that's a socialist image as such. I think it's one of justice, that people say there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, that's true, but there's such a thing as a prepaid lunch. And I think that, in some sense, the technologies that we're finding changing the world now have come almost directly out of the toil and the effort, quite often very badly underpaid, of all the people in the world. And so, even the raw materials are usually sequestered away from those who are the true owners. So I think that in the short term, while we're going through the dislocation to abundance, it probably does make a lot of sense. Well, it's a morally appropriate thing to do, that people should be paid from this intermediate abundance that's coming from, you know, let's say, replacing humans by robots.
It's been puzzling to me. You're speaking as a kind of lefty. You say it's not socialism, but it's a kind of a lefty idea. And it's been puzzling to me since I got interested in this transhumanist milieu that there is so little techno-optimism or techno-utopianism left in left circles, that most leftists are so Luddite Is it the same in Australia? Is it an American phenomenon where every person left of center has to be an immediate critic and hostile to any kind of industrialized or technological future? Are there folks over there who are optimistic and progressive at the same time?
Yeah, I think things are, in fact, much more optimistic in Australia. And I can also understand why people of the left in America would feel that way. I mean, there's plenty of reason to be suspicious of those who beat the corporate drum. We've heard all sorts of things in the past about how wonderful technology will be, how it's going to liberate people, and quite often it's done exactly the reverse. But, I mean, I must tell you that from the vantage point of Australia, American values do seem pretty strange sometimes. We share a lot of them, but, for example, we find it very, very odd that part of the, you know, the American doctrinal system seems to be that you must, as a natural right, be encouraged to put machine guns into the hands of teenagers, and that to do anything else would be some kind of sin against liberty. I mean, I find that bizarre. I just have to say that. On the other hand, the spirit of American enterprise is clearly the motor of the world these days. And, you know, one can only hope that Russia, for example, soon learns to make use of it rather than, you know, the kind of banditry that they've got running at the moment.
Well, when it comes down to it, I think our American teenagers are going to defend democratic capitalism from the Afghanis better than you unarmed Australians. That's for sure. The transhumanist phenomenon in Europe also seems to be much more politically diverse. I know that you've been a frequent monitor and participant in the online transhumanist discussions. Does it seem like there's a growing political diversity to this techno-optimist movement, this movement looking forward to anticipating these technologies?
There should be, but what I found, I mean, the main list that I've been spending time on is the Extropians, who, by definition, you know, by their charter, are in fact all fairly optimistic capitalists. So I tend to keep my political opinions fairly low to the ground while I'm there and not try to impose them on others. But there have
been more than can be said for most of them.
Over the 5 or 6 years that I've been watching the Extropians, there have been any number of interesting, clever, leftish Europeans mostly who come and add their piece and basically are driven away by the barking. There are a few. There's a wonderful Swedish neuroscientist named Anders Sandberg, who I quote quite a bit in The Spike, who hangs in there. But, you know, I think that the point is that we're interested in the facts of the technologies more than anything else. The interpretations, the political interpretations, are of interest. But what's most interesting to me is simply the fact that this stuff is coming down the pike at us very fast. And it's going to change everything in a very, very large way.
I've been speaking with Damian Broderick. He's the author of The Spike, which is out here in the United States, How Our Lives Are Being Transformed by Rapidly Advancing Technologies. And he's senior fellow at the University of Melbourne and the author of more than 30 science fiction and nonfiction titles. What are you working on next, Damian?
Well, I've just finished another science fiction novel that works on this. I'm actually considering a venture into theology, but I better not talk about that at the moment.
I really want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, James.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.